Hello, I'm Tom Edwards and welcome to The Big Interview on Monocle 24. My guest today is a graphic designer and award-winning filmmaker, former creative director at Wolf Olins and now partner at Pentagram in London. Born in Brazil, Marina Willer came to the capital, now her adopted home, to study at the Royal College of Art, where she took an MA in graphic design. Marina's work since for the likes of Tate and South Bank Centre and for organisations like Amnesty, Oxfam and Macmillan Cancer Support has shaped the contemporary design landscape and caught the public imagination, while her films have received critical acclaim, whether screened at festivals or at the likes of Fondation Cartier in Paris and the ICA here in London. An outspoken and unique voice in design today, I'm delighted to say that Marina joins me in the studio here at Midori House. Marina, welcome to The Big Interview. It's great to have you with us. Thanks for coming to see us and coming to talk to us. We've got lots of things to discuss, but I thought I'd start a little bit just about background, because I think when people talk about great design and when they talk about interesting lives, it's always about sort of origin stories. People are interested in the origins of brands, but people are interested in the origins of people too. And I guess your family story is very interesting. I know that you're working on a film which looks at some of these elements. Maybe you could just kind of bring us up to speed and tell us a bit about your family background, how it sort of came back to Europe via Brazil, of course, from Europe originally. Tell us a bit about the origins of your story.
I ended up here because I came to study at Royal College of Art. I'm from Brazil and my family is a real mixture, like many in Brazil, because after the war, a lot of people ended up there after the First World War and the Second. Brazil is a real mixture, and I decided to make this film because of what's going on in the world now with the refugee crisis in Europe. So many people are closing doors and becoming quite xenophobic, and I feel that Brazil is an inspiration in how much we learned from refugees and how much that was a gift for Brazil. And the tragedies of the wars, we really welcomed people coming from all over the world and bringing knowledge and cultures. And my family is a result of that salad. And we are so lucky that we've had all these different influences. And I thought that telling this story could be an inspiration if I can do justice to the story. Mm. And that's why I'm doing it. And my family has a bit of everything, Czech. And my mum is French, my dad's Czech. Jewish, Czech, and German, and I'm Brazilian, and you've got Hungarian, you've got a bit of everything, really. And I ended up back here, and my children are here, married to a man from the north of England. So we've got a bit of everything, really.
I mean, that's a good point to ask you then about where London is right now, because obviously you've kind of settled here, you live and work here, as you say. And you talk there about the human wealth in all its forms that you get from the movement of people and all this. But you also alluded to something rather darker, which is this intolerance, xenophobia, I guess we've got to call it, especially in the aftermath of all the Brexit and all of that. Are you still confident that you'll be happy to live and work in London, I don't know, over the next 2, 3, 4 years? Do you think the city's changing? Are there enough positives and enough strengths from like-minded people that you think we'll endure the worst?
Yeah, we're all hoping there will be, but I think so many like-minded people were devastated with what happened, and we're a bit surprised that everyone's been a bit quieter since then. But, you know, we have seen in a way that Brexit has encouraged a lot of people to come out even and be more vocal about racism. And even in, sadly, like, my children go to an amazing school in Hackney that is so diverse. It's a government school. But we see stories of children in schools saying, you know, oh, now you have to leave and crazy things like that, because they think they hear these stories on TV and so on. So we really hope that, you know, we're not going to become more parochial and more a small town or Little Britain. We hope that we can remain being Europe. You know, we've always been one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world, or if not the one. And that's what attracted me to come here. I think it's amazing, and I hope that we can carry on being like that.
We'll talk a bit more about your career later. A thing that strikes me as interesting is you've talked before about the lessons that you learn through when projects maybe don't go well. Professional failures can help you to sort of learn and develop as much as great successes. On that point, the whole Brexit thing, it feels like a big failure, but do you think the collective can learn from it? Does that same logic apply as it does in individuals' lives, that you can, I don't know, you can make more progress as a result of failure? Or is that just wishful thinking, do you think?
Well, I don't like when we start to think that we just have to accept things. But on the other hand, I think there is such a thing as sort of dichotomy, where history has always gone through period cycles, and there is contrast. There are opposites that trigger each other without being too kind of strong Marxist about it. I think it's just a natural thing that makes you realize also that there was a whole side of this country that felt excluded and sadly voted like that. And they're probably the ones who will suffer most from this. But it also makes a lot of people think of all the things that were perhaps not right. And, you know, there was not enough integration, that there was a lot of separation and many things that we need to do to be really cosmopolitan, because London was cosmopolitan, but the rest of Britain was not.
Exactly. Well, no, exactly. London is.
I'm not like a specialist at all. I'm just speaking from my heart and from the things you see as a citizen.
Well, that's often where the most powerful testimony comes from, I think, is just individuals and their instincts. Let's go back. That was a bit morbid. Sorry about that. I don't know why we started on that negative tone. Let's go back to happier times then and talk a bit about your studying at the Royal College of Art, of course, where subsequently you've been an external examiner. You've had a long relationship with that institution. Going back to your, I guess, your training, your studies, did you sort of know what you wanted to do with your life? Did you have a clear view, or was it something that built up a bit over time?
Well, I think things happened quite organically for me, but I think I do have a point of view on things, and I want to express those through my work. But my work is really a hybrid between design and film and all kinds of different media. And when I went to college, I had that wish, but I had no idea, for example, that I wanted to make films. And I started there. Royal College is a really amazing place to discover things and discover yourself. And also, because you've seen so much around you, it's very open. And I think you have to not know where you're going, but you have to be able to have initiative and be able to find your own direction. But you've got so much encouragement and inspiration. And then it's a framework, really, with a lot of encouragement and so on. So it was ideal for me.
This is interesting, because I know you've talked a lot before about your, I mean, and I think people might struggle to believe it, but you talk a little bit about sort of disorganisation and a sort of illogical way that sometimes you work, and maybe a slight chaotic, there's an organisation that comes through chaos. But do you think that's a problem? Because a lot of people, when it comes to design, I suppose, as a discipline, for want of a better word, often talk about exactly that, a discipline, or there might be a creative director who's very set on, you know, the grids on his page, and if you design a magazine, it must accord to these conventions. Is it a balancing act to maintain a disciplined approach with the necessary, you know, freedom of approach to be creative?
I think that's the magic. I think I tried to, obviously, I use that as a provocation, because without a grid and without a framework, it's very difficult to create beauty, I think. You know, it's like in nature, there is some kind of order in nature. But the problem is that a lot of design, and I'm not excluding myself from that, I'm just observing us as a collective, tends to kill the whole magic, because we put so much discipline sometimes that there is nothing, no space for participation or for people to co-create with us. In the times we live in, I think it's impossible to just say, okay, everyone has to now use Helvetica, or everyone now has to use the certain colour. You know, we have to allow people to choose and to work with us, and we can put the framework and let things grow within that framework and invite people to do that with us. And that's the magic that we're all trying to figure out how to do. But I think that sometimes there's so much framework and so much weight on that, that there's no space for anything else. I think I find inspiration in the kind of chaos around us and the way things organically grow. But I do also really respect the kind of Swiss design and the beauty of balance and harmony. Mm. It's just being able to do, to take from that, and also to allow that growth to kind of come in. I think that's, you know, how you negotiate between the two, for me, is the magic of design in our times. I think the dictatorship days are over. Although, you know, not for some, but I think for me that more and more participation is what people want. Otherwise, you see those brands that quickly get just destroyed, or they don't last, because they are made by some kind of specialist, and they're not really everyone owned by everyone. They really just become stagnant.
So, Marina, if you're working, or you get a commission, or you're working on a, I don't know, say like a, you know, a brand identity for a well-known brand, and obviously we can talk about some of your most celebrated projects later. People often say, look, the most important thing is to reflect, say, things like the story, the heritage of the brand first and foremost. Do you go along with that, or do you think that a great piece of design can even almost transcend that, and it can come from outside, and maybe necessarily it's better that it comes from outside, it brings a freshness of thinking? Or do you have to sort of bring those two ideas together to come up with a, I don't know, a branding concept or whatever that really, really works?
I think that both components are really important, and because history is part of the story, and where we are today is also part of the story. So if you ignore history, then just like, you know, using a rubber and ignoring and not learning from the past. But then if you also just do that, it feels like you're not going to the future. And I think, or you're also not inviting any, it's just, things are not alive, and they're just like a museum. And I think you need to be able to do both, and you need to negotiate past and future and present, which is, you know, the user and who's going to use, wants to be able to somehow feel like they have a voice. That's why things are either ever changing, or they react, or they have some kind of, some kind of reaction to things. But I think that every brief is different as well. I think, you know, there are things which sometimes have to be very solid because they are what they are. You know, there are things which just need to express solidity and safety. And the way I tend to work is really very much coming from the purpose of something and the way things have to behave. And design is not decoration, but it really has to reflect their behavior. And if it is, I remember when we were doing the Amnesty identity, it's very much a fighter organization. So, for example, you don't mess about with that candle, because that candle saves lives. And if you change that, it will confuse everyone. And also typeface, colors, all of those things. We created a behavior which was about intervening. And like censorship is very brutal, we did something that was more about intervening in a way to call attention. And it was quite fighting, and it wasn't very much about ever changing or being lighthearted and playful, because Amnesty is not that. Amnesty is saying, if we don't save this life now, you know, tomorrow is too late. So I think you need to know what...
So you can reflect the fact that it's a serious, you know, it's a serious business.
It's serious, it has to be done now. And it's about, we behave in a certain way, which is according to the need and the purpose of that organization, being commercial or not. Whilst when we're doing Oxfam, it's much more participative and about bringing pieces together and all of that. So using another. So it's very much about the behavior of the organization. And I think sometimes you just think everything has to be singing and dancing and ever changing. And then it might make some organizations or whatever look frivolous. And something else, a luxury hotel, does just want to be really beautiful and like a diamond. And that's it, isn't it? So I think it comes very much from the need and what the thing is there to do in the world.
If we talk about the kind of craft of great design, do you think it's threatened by anything? Whether that's, yeah, the approach that businesses take, maybe they're a bit conservative with a small c about what they want or what they want to allow designers to do. Does the kind of digital world that we live in now, does that offer up a different pressure? Because everyone talks about how processes like design is democratized now because everyone can get all of this stuff and there's all this information at everyone's fingertips. Is that a good thing? It's interesting that a lot of designers or companies are putting value on pre-digital things, you know, old guidebook physical items, which a lot of designers take inspiration from. Do you think that's a reaction to some of that pressure from digital, or are you just a big fan of what digital means we can all do in design terms?
I think it's not a coincidence that people are really going back to the manuals and the things that look good, because there was a moment that there was this fascination with digital, as if we can all do design just because we own a laptop or a computer. And I think also that anything that moves is, you know, and I've seen a lot of brands that I was one of Owai was creating, then suddenly shapes that we really were done, you know, sometimes there were many shapes. They were carefully crafted, inspired by modernism or something, and then someone refreshes it and says, oh, it just changes and it doesn't matter what it looks like. And I was really offended, thinking there was a tribute to a design and an era and it was a craft there. And I just confirming what you said, I think that just because it's digital times, it doesn't mean that anything will do. And I think that this return to is a celebration of what design can do. And I think that we may be getting to a time that, you know, it's just showing that design is still really important and it can be published in different ways because of the digital world, but it doesn't mean that anything will do, basically. Mm. I think it's really offensive to design that you just do anything, and it's just a tool, the digital media. It changes behavior, yes, but it doesn't allow any crap to be called design, I think.
Yeah. And it's not an end in itself, which I think people, we've been spending about a generation trying to figure that out. Let's talk a bit more about your design story, if you like. Obviously, you work for Pentagram here in London, one of the great names, an incredible company, and you're the first female partner in London, is that? I believe
yes.
That's right. Do you see yourself then as something of as being in a bit of a vanguard in that respect, or do you find that a tedious question if people say, "Oh, isn't it great that you know Pentagram's such an enlightened company and you're you know flying the flag for female designers"? Do you think that you are doing that, or do you just think, "No, I'm just flying the flag for good design"?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I when I did this talk the other day at the V&A, and I was trying to be very humorous about it because I do get very funny comments, and I laugh a lot at it. And I
is
was
that
doing,
is it a frustration though?
No. I mean, I have to say it's true that there aren't so many women in lead positions in design, and there are reasons for that. And I would feel guilty if I didn't admit that, and if I didn't help change, because I see a lot of amazing talents that women designers or artists and illustrators that went to college with me, and they didn't continue at some point because they were struggling with, you know, looking after the children, or they weren't as, you know, sometimes men find it easier to be aggressive in the business world. There's lots of other things which are to do with what we know is some kind of oppression that happens, and we can't deny that. So I don't like so much. We laughed the other day. I was doing a talk together with Kate Moross, and she said, you know, I'm not a woman designer, I'm a designer. And we like when we're called designers. Not, but it is true that there isn't equality, and there are reasons why this happens. And there is a lot of comedy in the way that we are treated sometimes. We can see. But at the same time, you know, I feel very, very lucky that I have partners who are amazing and very, you know, I'm in a very good environment, and all my partners who are not women, but they are really, really great, great guys. And we get on really well. And I think we would love to have more women partners. Yes, that's something we talk about all the time.
And it's interesting on a sort of a parallel to that, because I know you've talked often about the sort of inspiration that you get from your family and from your kids in particular, and that they sort of keep, I guess, say in a way, they sort of keep you honest with their appraisal, their view of the world. I've seen you talk before very entertainingly about the sort of way that your kids can wrong foot you with the complete candor, the honesty of their remarks. Do you think that there is something in kids' completely open way of looking at the world and that willingness to ask any question, however ridiculous it might be, which I guess the whole system slightly drives out of people, whether it's a system of education or the system of work? There is something rather magical about the innocence of the way kids look at the world, which actually we'd all be better served trying to retain or trying to listen to a bit more in our, well, in our personal lives as well as in our professional lives.
Yeah, in a way, I think before we have kids, we kind of, there's a risk we take ourselves too seriously, and then they just bring us back down to...
There's truly no escape. You know, I've got a 13-month-old, so I'm learning this.
You can't wait.
Day by day. Well, and you seem to find it a lot more entertaining and sort of easy than I am finding it presently. So I'm trying to take inspiration.
But it's all coming. But it's, yeah.
Well, exactly. But there's something, there is something kind of amazingly innocent. How do you retain that perspective with all of the demands that are on, you know, that are on your time and that are on you, you know, mentally, intellectually?
I think, yeah, part of it is always saying, you know, it's not rocket science, and it's not brain surgery or anything. We're not saving lives, and we can't think that we are just some kind of genius. And also that I think inspiration comes from all of us, and not that day of the Leonardo da Vinci designer is gone. And I think the more we see it like that, we see that we're just completely normal people that are lucky to be doing what we're doing. And the children are sometimes so much more talented than we are, and their questions are so much more clever, and their drawings are so much more beautiful. And that makes you just realize that, you know, if in a way they could not lose that, you know, they would be really, really magical in the world. But there's something that we just really get more and more squared up as we grow up, sadly, by all the things that we know happen, the system, the schools and the jobs that we, yeah. So for me, it's a really big inspiration.
And I guess, again, as a sort of parallel to that, there's this idea that you've talked about before about this kind of organized chaos, the way that you work. Is that really the true picture? Because like I said at the start, you know, I think people who see your work and your track record of delivering so many amazing projects, you know, would say, well, hang on, that, you know, that can't be the case. It must all be running like clockwork. Is there a bit of chaos? Is there a bit of creative disorder? And do you think actually in your case, do you need that? Does that help kind of spark the creative process?
Yeah, it's not like I work in a crazy desk or anything and my house is a mess. I think it's not that at all. I think it's just the way you look at the world. Simply, it's just that, the things you see and being able to look at something mad and seeing beauty in there. And I see artists like, I don't know, like Richard Wentworth, or I just thought of him now for a minute, but there's so many others that, you know, see very simple things and they inspire me, because, and filmmakers and so on, when they see those things and they, you know, and so many people can just pass by and not see. I think it's more in that kind of way. But the way we work, and then I am surrounded by people who I think do craft really well, and I think it's really important. And I really love coming up with ideas all the time, and I love color, and I love the visual side of, and the ideas and all of that, and concepts. But I do also know that I need to be surrounded by people who are very Swiss, I like to say, and very precise, because I think that craft is as important as that. I'd never neglect that. I think it's the two things coming together.
Let's talk a little bit about how then a project comes together. We can take an example of something like, so that you're very well known for, maybe the, you know, the Tate Identities from when you were back at Wolf Olins working with Brian Boylan, of course, in the, I think, late 90s, wasn't it? When do you know that a project is really going to be something special? Is it one of those things that, again, it's rather organic, or is there a moment, or is it almost way back at the commission stage where everything just falls into place? Or is it the opposite, and actually it's not really till it's very far down in development that you sort of look back and go, wow, that was pretty good? Can you get a feeling about how well something's going?
I think with Tate was very special, because obviously it's such an incredible organization. And I also think that, well, working with Brian, we always had such a strong partnership, but it really started there, because I was very young and he is very intellectual. We were working with the team of curators, and we were, you know, always working together in terms of what do we call it and all of that. And he was sort of driving the team in terms of strategy. But I was trying to express the idea, and he came up with this summarizing thought of all the things they were talking about, which was look again, think again, which is kind of their brand idea. And that was a notion that everything is always changing, that everyone has to, through art, always invite themselves to think differently about art and the world, and art makes you think like that. So I was thinking, how can I do something that is always changing? So I, every day, put myself this task. There was a tiny room at the top of Wolf Olins, and I was making an installation every day hanging the word Tate and projecting and with mirrors, like completely crazy. But I had just come out of Rock College, so you come with that. And everyone
thought, this is how all projects go, right?
Yeah. And everyone thought I was a bit mad. So I was projecting and filming those things, and that ever-changing identity came out of that. And I think the great thing was also Nick Serota, because he was very special, and he saw that route and he immediately said, that's it. So that was the click moment. He knew. I think when you have a visionaire and a client that's very clear, I think it really helps.
But you need to have sometimes all the minds have
the
to
clients don't really know where they're going, and that's very difficult. There was a large group of people, but Nick just kept saying, this is the route, this is the one I wanted. And I was really lucky because I was very young at that time, and there were lots of other routes going on. But so for me, it was very exciting and scary, like these things happen a bit. Yeah, but it was very special, yeah.
Tell me a bit more about inspiration, because it's interesting, we've talked about art a couple of times and you talked about artists and the way that they look at the world. Do you find that you go to the world of art, whether it's contemporary art or fine art, for inspiration? Is it more about people? I know that you've sort of worked with and looked at the work of great architects, you know, Richard Rogers, people like this. Are there kind of go-to environments or people where if you think I need to find a little spark of something more, is it about going to particular places?
It's a habit that I've always had, but until I had children, it was a bombardment for me. It was like I used to go to the cinema like every night. I used to go to spend the whole weekends on galleries, but also traveling a lot. And when I was a student, it was like there was no free time and all of that. Now I'm much more chilled, because also it's not that, but I think you get... it's difficult because you feel you owe a lot to your children and you do things. And then I find that the inventions we make together are equally inspiring. And sometimes you get a bit of an overload of the gallery thing, and you find other types of, it's a different program almost. So it's a balance. And I wish I could do as much cinema as I did before. And then I'm working so much on my film that every free time. So it's not the same in terms of that. What I find is that those days really were, it's like an archive inside you. All that reading and bombardment of stuff is all here. And the curiosity is what keeps you going.
That's good. That's useful. A subconscious archive.
Yeah, and sometimes it's a shop with buckets and, you know, it's not always galleries only. It's all kinds of weird things.
Inspiration everywhere. Yeah. Well, that's rather a nice thought. And what about for your kids having a multifaceted sort of upbringing? Are you ever tempted, or might you, I don't know, go back to Brazil or move somewhere else?
We're very open, but we do love London so much. I think the only thing that could push us is Brexit. If the city changes... I came here because of how cosmopolitan and open it was. And if, you know, I think both me and Stuart, we both feel the same, that if this is not like this anymore and if the mentality changes, then it's not what we want. And we want to raise our children in a very diverse... We love when we see how open-minded they are and what they get from the school where they are. And if it's not going to be like this, I think we'll feel... they won't be getting the education we feel threatened as well.
Marina, it's been fantastic to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming to share so many recollections about your career and your working practices and all sorts of stories. It's been really great to speak with you. Thanks for being with us on The Big Interview.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Tom Edwards, in conversation with Marina Willer. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Lutie and Gaia Lutz and edited by Claire Crofton. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye and thank you for listening.